and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this President's Day with demonstrations in opposition to the month-old Trump administration across the country, organized around the theme of Not My President's Day. One of the organizers of today's demonstrations, Melanie Manos, joins us from Detroit. She is one of the lead organizers of Bad and Nasty, an online art and activist community organizing Not My President's Day coordinated performances and actions around the country. We'll discuss the role of the arts, satire, and humor that has emerged as a way to both deal with the reality of a Trump presidency and protest it, as millions of people in the U.S. and around the world are taking to the streets in more and more demonstrations, which started with the women's marches on the day after Trump's inauguration. They drew huge crowds compared to the day before, a comparison that has not sat well with Trump, who has been offering up his own altered reality and alternative facts ever since. Then we will speak with Rick Claypool, the research director at Public Citizen, who is the author of a new report just out, For-Profit President, that analyzes Trump's first 30 days in a day-by-day review of the new Trump administration's first month that has seen an extraordinary grant of power to corporate interests in Donald Trump's get-rich-quick scheme known as the American presidency. We will discuss this full-fledged assault on our health, safety, environment, workers, consumers, financial security, civil rights, and other protections. Then finally, we'll look into the report by the New York Times on an initiative by close Trump associates involving a back-channel plan for Trump to lift sanctions on Russia in exchange for a peace plan with Russia and Ukraine. Alexander Motel, a professor of political science at Rutgers University, whose latest book is Ukraine versus Russia, Revolution, Democracy, and War, joins us to discuss the shady characters in this deal involving a disgraced Ukrainian politician, a Russian-American businessman with longstanding ties to Trump and prior convictions for stock manipulation involving the mafia, along with Trump's personal attorney. And joining us now is Melanie Manos, who's one of the lead organizations of Bad and Nasty, an online art and activist community who are organizing demonstrations on this Not My President's Day and coordinating performances and actions around the country. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melanie Manos.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, tell us about Bad and Nasty. Does that come from the line in the debates against Hillary Clinton where Donald Trump called her a nasty woman?
Exactly. And then also referencing the bad hombres.
Oh, I see.
That he keeps calling Latinos or immigrants. Correct. So actually, Bad and Nasty was started by Holly Hughes, two performance artists, Holly Hughes and Lois Weaver. And they spread the word, and we decided to jump on to this nationwide event, and we're doing our version in Detroit.
And what's it going to look like in Detroit then?
So we are at a repurposed building that was once a church and is now used as a performance space. And we're going to start, I'm the MC, and I'm going to start off with what I call faux drag, which is essentially like a woman doing a man doing a woman, and start off the evening with a song, and then we're going to go right into a shadow puppet performance. It's beautiful. They're setting it up right now with projection and these beautifully hand-cut puppets that will be projected. You know, with the shadows be projected. And then we have a variety. We have some dance numbers. We have a couple of vocalists. And we have the Black and Brown Theater that's going to do a very short theater piece. So we have a really nice mix of work.
So you're in Michigan, obviously, Detroit. And the three the three key states that Hillary Clinton lost were Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. By a very narrow margin, only 77,000 votes. And that's why we have Donald Trump. And, of course, he keeps talking about this massive victory he had in the Electoral College. But it really, his victory came down to 77,000 votes. So, in effect, you're at the front line there. So what's your sense of, one, what went wrong? And, two, whether how do you reach the people, even that 77,000 who voted for him, because my understanding is that he didn't win by some people so much voting for him on amongst his supporters, but it was rather that Hillary Clinton supporters, or those supporters of who had also previously supported Barack Obama, just simply weren't enthusiastic and didn't show up. In other words, this is more about a loss for the Democrats than a victory for the Republicans.
Yeah, I would have to agree, and I would say that to that end, that I think part of the problem was that the Clinton campaign didn't campaign enough in those three states. Debbie Stabenow, that's a senator in Michigan, said for a year she was telling the Clinton campaign she thought that Trump could win Michigan, and kept saying, you need to come, you need to pay more attention to Michigan. So I think there were a lot of people who stayed home, unfortunately, which in my mind is terribly disappointing in light of who we've got now in the presidency. And a lot of people in those three states focused on jobs, and he was able to convince them that he could make those come back, which is not necessarily true, but he convinced them. And they just didn't hear enough from the Democrats. That's my opinion.
And again, I'm speaking with Melanie Manos, who's one of the lead organizers of Bad and Nasty, an online art and activist community organizing Not My President's Days demonstrations and coordinated performances and actions around the country. And she joins us from Detroit, where there's about to be a performance, right, as well as an action. Can we touch on the other cities around the country? I mean, New York, L.A., I'm here in L.A., of course. I'm familiar with what's happening here. What other cities or, you know, parts of the country are the Bad and Nasty performances going to be on today?
Oh gosh, I haven't looked at the map recently, but if you go to badandnasty.com, they have a map site where that has each location highlighted. There's a number of them in the Midwest area. There's a few on the East Coast. They keep being added. You know, there's quite a few in the New York City area, and I know there's actually a couple in London, in the UK. So it's actually gone a little bit more past our borders, as it were.
Right. Well, there's a huge demonstration right across from the Parliament House in London. It's been going on all day. But I think
haven't had a minute to look at the news.
Well,
I'm glad to hear.
I know you're busy and you've got things to do. But in Britain, of course, they're demonstrating in front of the Parliament because they don't want the Parliament to invite Donald Trump on a state visit.
Yeah.
And then one of the parliamentarians accused the government of pimping out the Queen in order to satisfy Trump. So, and then, of course, that was considered to be rather distasteful language in reference to our sovereign.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk.
I'm sure it was.
You know, clearly there's been an awful lot of demonstrations, starting with the day after Donald Trump's inauguration, where millions of women around the country and around the world spontaneously demonstrated. So what's going on there? My sense is that there's an awful lot of political energy out there in search of strategy. Do you think that eventually, I mean, on the one hand, my feeling is the more demonstrations, the better, and they have to be on every day, and they have to be sustained, and they have to be in this guy's face, because he's obviously incredibly sensitive about the size of everything to do with him, including demonstrations for and against, and he's largely in denial about what's happening. But on the other hand, at what point is there a sort of strategy here at the end of the day? In other words, let me ask you this directly. What, at the end of the day, do you want to achieve?
Yeah, it's a really good point, I think, in terms of demonstrations and then strategy. And it's something that I've been thinking a lot about. I think there needs to be both. And for us as artists, I think the biggest thing to achieve is reminding ourselves that we have community and that we have to keep this resistance strong. And so this is one way of doing it. However, I feel strongly that we all, and it's probably something I'm going to say while I'm emceeing, is everyone has to stay active in a really strategic way. And that means at local and state level, not just protesting Trump. But our state has undergone a huge amount of gerrymandering, so that even though the state supposedly is blue. You know, it's churning red, but our state government is all red, and that's because of gerrymandering. So our governors are the Republicans. Congress is run by Republicans. So I really think it's important for Democrats in this state and in other states, too, that are in this kind of situation to look at local and state government and see how can they change things at those levels and not just be going, you know, anti-Trump. Because well, that's the way we're going to get things back nationally.
Sure. Well, I think what happened to your state, Michigan, is what's happened to the whole country vis-a-vis the Republicans. It's not just gerrymandering. It's money, because Betsy DeVos is a billionaire. Snyder is a millionaire, you know, hedge fund guy. So it's all about money, too. But you got the numbers. You got the people. So it's people versus money, isn't it?
So what do you mean we've got the numbers?
Well, I think, first of all, more people voted for the other person, Hillary Clinton, than this guy.
Yeah.
And the fact that millions are showing up, and millions showed up the day after his inauguration, and you've got people out there today, and there are thousands and thousands of people around the country demonstrating today, and they did yesterday here in Los Angeles, lots of people in support of immigrants and the roundups that are about to happen there. So something's happening, but my sense is...
I hope so.
You know, we're talking about numbers versus money, and,
right.
At the end of the day, that's what we have, right?
Yeah, and then hopefully it's some of the coming together with the Bernie Sanders people and the millennials. There were a lot of millennials that didn't want to vote for Clinton because they were upset about Bernie Sanders, you know, and so there's some uniting that has to happen.
Well, just in closing then, since your organization, Bad and Nasty, as we said, you know, it's the bad hombres and calling Hillary Clinton a nasty woman.
Nasty woman. I have a nasty woman t-shirt.
And you're doing your best to be a nasty woman, right? So,
that's right.
So tell me, though, just in general, one of the things that I find heartening about the pushback against Trump is the quality of the kind of satire, and I take it that's a part of what you're doing today. For example, Saturday Night Live, you know, Alec Baldwin has been incredibly effective spoofing Trump, and Melissa McCarthy's just been absolutely brilliant.
I know, as it's saving Sean's, my life, I feel.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about that, you know, humor and satire being the...
Alec's brilliant. It's and also, there's also really some smart comedy happening, like Samantha Bee. She's so on point, and John Oliver... and then the Saturday Night Live, but, you know, it gives us a chance to release a little bit, you know what I mean? But it's also very on point and poignant and well done satire. So, I'm thankful for all those terrific comedians.
Well, I'll let you go. I know you're about to perform.
Yeah, I got to go put on one of my wigs.
Well, I hope it's a nasty one, right?
I'm kind of doing a character that's, I'm calling her Malanka. Sort of like, so it's like, I have short, dark hair, but it's like a straight blonde wig.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I'll start with that. Yeah, and then I'm doing a Marie Antoinette character called Bad Marie.
I see. So Malanka and Marie Antoinette.
Yeah, Dad Marie. Okay. Yeah, because I kind of feel like we're in a monarchy again, so.
All right. let the meat cake, right?
That's right, exactly. I have a bunch of individually wrapped cakes that we're going to throw out to the audience.
Oh, you are? Oh, good for that.
Yeah.
All righty. Well, I enjoyed talking with you.
You as well.
Michelle, Melanie, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Melanie Manos, who is one of the lead organizers of Bad and Nasty, an online art and activist community organizing Not My President's Day demonstrations and coordinated performances and actions around the country today on this President's Day, otherwise known as Not My President's Day. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the author of a new report just out, For Profit President. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rick Claypool, who is the Research Director for the President's Office at Public Citizen, where his main area of research includes corporate crime and accountability, money in politics, and drug pricing. He's the author of a new report from Public Citizen, For-Profit President. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rick Claypool.
Thank you, Ian.
And I take it this report is about Trump's first 30 days and what is being described in your report as a wholesale corporate takeover of government. So tell us about the report and the scope of it.
That's right. So we looked at every day in the past 30 days of what the president has been doing through the lens of what is being done for corporate interests, how he's enriching his own private business, and how he's putting people who are at the executives and corporate leaders in power. And it really is breathtaking. Every day there is just decisions are being made and moves are being made by this Trump administration that is just gift after gift to corporate America.
Well, you have to sort of start with the cabinet, don't you? Isn't the makeup of the cabinet almost entirely a gift to corporate America, if not the Koch brothers?
That's right. So, I mean, the cabinet is packed with corporate executives or those who have devoted their political lives to carrying out the interests of those corporations. You mentioned the Koch brothers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and those kinds of corporate interest groups are, they've had long wish lists for policies for a long time, and now they're working on installing these individuals who are just come at it from this the policy perspective, come at it from this sort of CEO bottom line perspective, with of course Tillerson from ExxonMobil and Steve Mnuchin from Goldman Sachs, among others from Goldman Sachs, like Gary Cohn and even Steve Bannon. You have others who just have, that is their, from the sort of development slash hedge fund slash real estate development universe, that are sort of these corporate raiders, people at this level of sort of buying and selling businesses, like Icahn and Wilbur Ross, where, all these parts of government are really just suddenly just seem to be, instruments for these sort of business titans to use to profit their, to make their, help their industries gain profits, and over and over again, you see it. It's in ways that are at the expense of workers and working people.
Well, in Trump's first full week in office, he had breakfast meetings with CEOs of a dozen corporations, including Iconic, Corning, Dell, Dow Chemical, Ford Motor Company, International Paper, Johnson & Johnson, Lockheed Martin, SpaceX, Under Armour, and U.S. Steel. And he's also met with Big Pharma and Wall Street people, as we mentioned. But that's, those are traditional corporate interests, I would suggest. But Paul Krugman, the Nobel economist, who's a columnist for the New York Times, in Monday's New York Times, is referring to Trump's administration as the administration of scammers and polluters. So can you make a distinction between, traditional corporate America that's always had its hooks into government, let's face it, and whether or not Trump is enabling the scammers and polluters and the bottom feeders, like the payday lenders, the for-profit college people? Is that what's happening?
Well, I think, I don't know the distinction there. I mean, it comes from, there are the actions that are that the administration is taking. I mean, certainly there are the actions that the Fortune 500 companies are asking for, whether it's dismantling the Dodd-Frank financial protections or getting just absolutely gutting the Environmental Protection Agency, or these sort of aggressive moves where they're even he's discussing with the airline interests about privatizing air traffic control. So it's not as if it's a sort of a marginal, or this is a very specific small or unseemly slice of corporate America. It is, I think it is, it goes to the top where you have, folks who are like, these groups who are of CEOs who are meeting with the president, and what they're saying over and over again is that the auto industry is saying we don't want emission standards. You have the oil and gas industry saying, well, we want to make sure we get these Keystone XL and Dakota pipelines through. We have the folks from the financial sector saying, okay, well, we need you to gut Dodd-Frank and weaken the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And that's what's happening. And that's how the president frames it, is that, oh, we're slashing regulations right and left. And by slashing regulations, we're going to unleash some kind of imaginary power of the economy that's going to make the country work better. It's going to improve the economy somehow, and all it really is going to do is let reckless corporations do whatever they want. It's going to, instead of having there being baseline requirements that prevent exploitation and stop pollution, and that that ensure that there are food and safety standards being upheld, it's increasingly going to be up to the companies to self-regulate, right? Which, the companies like that, but because they feel like, there's this ideological resentment of having requirements that maybe, some inspector might tell them they're breaking the rules, or there might be some sort of enforcement authority against them. And repeatedly, that's what the new administration is getting rid of, and that's a real, real serious cause for concern.
And again, I'm speaking with Rick Claypool, who's a research director for the president's office at Public Citizen, where his main areas of research include corporate crime and accountability, money in politics, and drug pricing. And he's the author of the new report from Public Citizen, For Profit President. So just I take your point that there's not really a distinction between bottom feeding scam artists and the attitude of corporate America in terms of this administration, Trump administration, being enablers for scammers and polluters. But certainly, I think the repealing the Obama administration's Labor Department rule requiring financial advisors to give advice to their customers, who of course are retirees, in terms of their pensions, that is advice in the best interest of retirees. And that rule, now that's been repealed, would have saved consumers, meaning retirees, $17 billion a year from rip-off fees from this bad advice. So it's amazing that the president, the champion of working America, who got elected on the basis that he was the champion of working America, could actually be so barefaced and brazen by basically saying, we're going to allow a bunch of crooked Wall Street scam artists to rip off your pension. And that we apparently a study's been done that indicates that this will reduce the value of every working American's pension by between 20% and 30%, because they're going to just load it up with fees and fine print and not really be working in the interest of you and the money, your hard-earned money, but working in their own interests. It's that simple.
Yes, and that's something that, with a straight face, Wall Street lobbyists have been, pushing for, they were fighting this tooth and nail when the Obama administration proposed it. And, what the argument seemed to come down to was that, unless we can rip people off, we're not going to be able to turn a profit, which is ludicrous.
Well, but again, this is a president on the first day. His first executive order was to make it more expensive for working American families to get a mortgage. How come that doesn't resonate? How come this extraordinary overturning of this Labor Department rule that enables Wall Street scam artists to steal people's pensions, Those are very fundamental facts, and they fundamentally affect the lives of working Americans. And yet somehow out there, there's this alternative universe where people still think that Donald Trump is the man on the white horse who's going to drain the swamp and make their lives better. So have you figured this out? Do you have any kind of way that we, you know, people like me can come up with a strategy to prick that bubble, to get those alternative facts, if you will, into the consciousness of people? Because I don't want to speak to the choir all the time. I'd like to be able to find a way to let these people know what this guy's really up to.
Well, I think, you know, there has been so much that has happened over the course of just the past 30 days. I mean, people have been drinking from the fire hose of Donald Trump news. And so I think for a lot of people, it's not even, I don't even know if it's a matter of cherry picking. It's just a matter of, you know, how many bits of information can I cling to at once to understand, and, you know, how can I paint a picture of it that makes sense, that this is what he's doing, and how can I understand why the administration is doing what it's doing. And I think that is that's part of the what we're trying to achieve here by doing this report and looking back on the this first 30 days from this lens, in terms of slice it from a perspective of, okay, well, what has the administration done to do favors for corporate interests, right? And this is particularly, you know, in light of, you know, during his closing argument, Trump's closing argument for the campaign was that he was going to drain the swamp, and he was going, I think he even echoed that over just this past weekend. He repeated that that theme, and he's talking about how there is an establishment, and it's rigging the system against the people. And I think, you know, when you go back and look for, okay, well, you know, who really is the establishment, in terms of, like, okay, who really is benefiting, who's profiting from the decisions being made, and who's rigging things to their benefit. I think the past 30 days, it's absolutely stunning to see all of the decisions that were made that are just transferring power to these two corporate interests and really just, you know, pandering to what they want. And you know, I think part of it is there's going to be some degree where, you know, people who were his supporters are not going to turn on a dime and say, oh, well, now I'm part of the resistance because, you know, he did this one thing within the first 30 days. But I think just it's the degree that it's going to pile up if somebody, I would hope if a reason why folks were supporting President Trump was because they thought he was going to take on the establishment and fight for working people, the actual actions that he's taking and documenting them, I would hope would have people you know, reflect on the choices they made and maybe see that this is. This seems like it's been an elaborate bait and switch in terms of what the president really is doing and the agenda he's really carrying out.
Well, it's a classic trick of con men to say that you're being conned, and I'm here to protect you from being conned.
That's
in
right.
Fact, I'm in fact pulling off the biggest con of all. And to what extent, though, does Trump kind of set the example here in terms of not wanting to even deal with conflicts of interest and ethical questions and the emoluments clause of the Constitution? He's gotten away with all. He never released his tax returns. He still owns his companies. He's just turned them over to his sons. and they're off opening golf courses in the Gulf and costing the taxpayer a fortune with Secret Service protection. He's down there in Mar-a-Lago every weekend now. He's upped the fees at Mar-a-Lago to $200,000 to join, so he's already capitalizing on his own fame as a president. He's got Kellyanne Conway, his aide, shilling for Ivanka, his daughter's products, and we're supposed to believe that somehow the two boys running the company don't consult with their father, that they talk about the Lakers and basketball games and baseball games at dinner and never anything about business. We're supposed to believe that?
Right. Yeah. No. It's astounding. But you know. But even if we did believe it, it's still the fact that all the business is entirely still in it's owned. He still owns it, and it's still he still ultimately profits from it, and he knows what political decisions that he makes will be more beneficial for the business. And case in point, one of the points that the Krugman column that you mentioned made really well was that we don't know whether or not the policies that that the administration puts forward are going to be good or bad for working people. They're going to be good for this billionaire class and these corporate executives who are pulling the strings. Case in point is tax policy, right? That's a very the simplest example where there are millions to billions in taxes at stake with reforms that are on the table, and it really could be devastating for so many programs that and that are benefit working people. People don't necessarily always see it firsthand or have firsthand experience with it, but it's like the release of cuts that are coming down the pike from violence against women's programs to PBS funding that are all sort of in proposed budget cuts from the administration. We're outside of the domain where these things really, the math of what they add up to is what is really trying to be preserved. It's sort of like a scalp from the past administration or from something that people want, that these sort of austerity extremists are just kind of trying to collect as fast as they can. And I don't know if that just they doing it quickly means they can set the terms of it for the next for as long as they're in power, or if it means they're not sure how long they're going to be in power, so they better do as much damage as they can while they can. But that is the pace of it.
Well, just in closing, for the audience to be able to get perspective on Donald Trump's get-rich-quick scheme known as the American presidency, Trump's first 30 days of wholesale corporate takeover of government, how do they get hold of your new report from Public Citizen, For-Profit President?
Sure. So you can go to Public Citizen's website, citizen.org, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll have links to the report available there. You can also find the report on Medium, and take a look, share, make sure, and sort of get an understanding of what really is happening under the Trump administration.
Rick Claypool, thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Rick Claypool, who's a research director for the President's Office at Public Citizen, where his main areas of research include corporate crime and accountability, money in politics, and drug pricing. And he's the author of the new report from Public Citizen, For-Profit President. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a report by the New York Times on an initiative by Trump associates to lift sanctions on Russia in exchange for a peace plan with Russia and Ukraine.
are sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we slave to keep the wealthy fat. They fill our heads with promises and bamboozle us with facts. Then they pull off false sincerity, then they laugh behind our backs.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Alexander Motel, who is a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and his latest book is Ukraine Versus Russia, Revolution, Democracy, and War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motel.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of the story that the New York Times broke on Sunday about this back-channel arrangement that a number of aides close to Donald Trump, his lawyer, Michael Cohen, this businessman, Felix Sater, a Russian-American businessman with a somewhat checkered background, Paul Manafort, of course we know about him, that they apparently came up with some kind of an alternative deal to get out of or to make a deal with Putin over Ukraine. And of course, they're in an alliance with a Ukrainian politician, Andriy Artemenko, who also has something of a checkered career. So, well, let's start with, I'm sure you're familiar with what's happening in Ukraine. How do the Ukrainians feel about this so-called peace plan?
Well, I mean, I've read a number of responses by official Kiev. I've read a number of articles and blogs, and it's been unanimous. They've been unanimous in their condemnation of the so-called peace plan. I mean, for one reason being that the American side consists of fly-by-night individuals. The other reason being that Artemenko is somewhat of a loose cannon and a fly-by-night individual as well. A third is that the whole thing strikes people as unrealistic and hence unlikely even to get off the ground, even if it were a good idea. And then finally, people resent the fact that this is going on, as it were, without Ukraine's participation. So it strikes some individuals as being indicative of some kind of larger Russo-Ukrainian plot to impose their will on Ukraine. Whether that's the case or not, I'm not so sure. But in any case, it's been roundly condemned, and I can't imagine that this thing will ever get off the ground, certainly not in Ukraine. And as you may know, I mean, Russia has condemned this as well. It's called it absurd. I think the chances of this thing getting off are virtually nil.
So I guess the conclusion then would have to be that this is the kind of amateurism that and freelancing that seems to go on with the Trump people. I mean, this cast of characters, they're not new to the in Trump world. Felix Sater is a Russian-American businessman with long-standing ties to Trump, and needless to say, also to stock fraud and the mafia. And of course, Michael Cohen is his longtime lawyer. He's the guy that put this thing together and dropped it on Trump's desk, apparently. And then you've got Paul Manafort, who was the former campaign manager for Trump. So,
as well as for Yanukovych, the Ukrainian dictator who was ousted in the revolution of 2014.
Right. So, you know, so what? This is freelancing, is it? This is amateurism, or
I think so. I mean, you know, you never know. I mean, Bannon might be pulling strings. For all we know, Trump might have sent someone a tweet to this effect a few months or a few weeks ago. But I think more likely than not, given the general tenor of this chaotic administration, is that these are just a bunch of guys who may have heard something from someone within the cabinet or within, or maybe even from Trump, and then felt empowered to pursue this. They contacted some shady Ukrainian, and there you go. And then the result is a so-called peace plan that hasn't been vetted by any serious diplomat on any side, neither the American nor the Russian nor the Ukrainian. And it's just, I think it's largely indicative, of, as you said, of this amateurish, of the amateurish nature of this particular administration. Now, there may be an additional element, again, because this fellow Artemenko, who, as I said, is, you know, fly-by-night character who's been expelled by his own party, which consists of fly-by-night characters. He claims to have some information, some compromising material on the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko. Now, this may simply be, you know, he may simply be a blowhard who's bringing to light things that we know from the Panama Papers, and none of them were very damning. I mean, there were just indications of some sort of slight shenanigans on Poroshenko's part. Or alternatively, if he's connected to Russia, which is not inconceivable, everything is possible nowadays, then the whole point of this exercise might be to provide some compromising materials on Poroshenko via the KGB and Russian disinformation campaigns. Now, that's possible. Again, is it likely? I have no idea. But it's certainly a possibility that this is a kind of a sub rosa goal of this bizarre mission. But the whole context, I mean, if you look more closely, I mean, if you look at what they're suggesting, the whole thing is absurd. I mean, they're arguing that Russia should withdraw. Well, of course, you know, everybody would agree with that, and people have been arguing that point since 2014. The problem with that is that Russia denies that it's even in eastern Ukraine, so there's nothing to withdraw. And then the second part of this suggests that the Ukrainians should hold a referendum on Crimea, and then either lease the Crimea to Russia for either 50 or 100 years. I believe those were the two dates. And that, of course, is a non-starter from the very beginning as far as Putin is concerned, because he insists that the whole thing was done legally, that there was never any violation of law. And every Russian policymaker will tell you that the question of Crimea has been settled once and for all, as they like to say. So a referendum, you know, might be a good idea if the Russians were on board, but since they're not, the whole thing is just silly. But I guess it's indicative of the fact, you know, you take a shady lawyer, you take a shady businessman, and you take a shady political consultant, each of whom is an amateur when it comes to Ukraine, Russia, and things like that. You put them all together, you add a shady Ukrainian policymaker, and the result is, well, is what it is.
Right. This fellow, Artemenko, the shady Ukrainian politician who is supposedly, they're going to try and put him in power. He spent 2.5 years in jail in Kiev in the early 2000s on embezzlement charges, which was subsequently dropped. And again, I'm speaking with Alexander Model, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University and previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. And his latest book is Ukraine versus Russia, Revolution, Democracy, and War. So let's then talk about the broader issues here. The same cast of characters, you know, to varying degrees, also show up in the Steele report, the dossier, the intelligence dossier that seems to be gradually getting more and more verified. And the New York Times and the Washington Post have been doing some investigative work on the Trump campaigns and Trump himself and the family's ties to the Russians. And a lot of people have been mystified by Donald Trump, the extent to which he goes out of his way to say nice things about Putin, defends him, even to the extent that he casts a kind of moral equivalence between Putin being a killer and the United States being a country that has blood on its hands as well. So something's going on there. And again, many of these characters are in that world as well. What's your sense of it? And since you follow this, obviously, and particularly follow stuff in Ukraine, I'd be interested to know what their sense is that you know, do people wonder whether this Putin put this guy in the White House or helped put him in the White House? And I'm not even sure that it's working out for Putin in any rational way. It seems at the end of the day it could really blow up in his face, and it's not entirely out of the question that sooner or later Trump himself could be impeached.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, you raise a number of important questions. I mean, one is, you know, did the Russians put him in the White House? And my guess is, I mean, based on the evidence I've seen of the hacking, of the tinkering, this, that, and so on, I mean, they clearly made a bit of a difference. I'm not sure if it would have been decisive. I mean, it would be comforting to think that they're responsible for his victory, but I suspect a significant portion of the American electorate is actually rather more directly responsible for that sad fact. That said, I have no doubt, personally, based on what I've read and simply based on the plausibility of the Steele report and on the former activities of the Soviet Union, Russia, their secret police, I personally have no doubt that the Steele report is absolutely accurate, which isn't to say that there aren't certain misstatements, but the notion that Trump is in bed with Russian big business is absolutely true. It is also true that a certain number of individuals from that sector are involved in Russian organized crime. Some of them are oligarchs. All of them, by virtue of being oligarchs, have broken the law in one fashion or other. So that's pretty much set. I think more importantly is that, you know, this business about golden showers, prostitutes, hotels, I mean, that just rings A, so true for Trump, and B, so true for the kind of typical KGB methods that they've been applying since the 1920s. I mean, this is your typical honeypot. We know that from John le Carré. And my personal guess is that what the Steele report contained is probably just the tip of the iceberg of the compromising materials that the KGB have on Mr. Trump. Which may account for the bizarre behavior, his kowtowing, his unwillingness to, you know, criticize the Russians. Now, that said, you raise another very important point, and that is the man is, in the final analysis, at best, a loose cannon. I mean, some individuals within the psychiatric community have suggested he may be ill, may be in need of treatment. Many pundits have suggested similar things as well. One doesn't have to be a psychiatrist to see that his erratic behavior isn't quite presidential and may suggest that something is wrong. What strikes me, above and beyond what everyone might say about him from a psychological point of view, is that the man is an inveterate pathological liar with a very, what's called, indirect relationship to facts and the truth. And what that means for someone like Putin is that he has, in effect, helped place into power an individual whom he, Putin, cannot ever trust. This is really the bottom line. I mean, consider what this means. Actually, it's even worse than that, because Putin himself is also a pathological liar with a tenuous relationship to the truth. So if these two individuals are to agree on anything, they have to overcome these vast reserves of mendacity, suspicion, and everything else. Putin's been able to get away with shocking the Americans under the Obama administration, with manipulating the Europeans, because the Americans under Obama and the Europeans under the EU, you know, they're basically nice guys who follow the rules and they try to behave like ladies and gentlemen. And then along comes this bull. He wrecks the China shop, everybody's too shocked, and they just kind of mumble and aren't sure as to how to respond. Trump is even more of a bull than Putin. And I think Putin will come to regret Trump's victory. Of course, it's conceivable that the entire world may come to regret Trump's victory, but that's another issue altogether. But certainly, he will have to deal with an individual whose word doesn't mean anything, who is ignorant, who does not understand the issues, and who is perfectly capable of saying one thing today and contradicting himself without batting an eyelash tomorrow. How can you possibly sign any kind of deal with an individual like this? And then last but not least, this is all blowing up in Trump's face, this entire Russiagate business. And that just makes him and his administration even more dysfunctional, even more incapable of making decisions. And certainly with the pressure that's mounting both amongst Republicans and Democrats regarding the suspicious Russian connection, Trump and et al. And his colleagues, they will be hard-pressed to kowtow to Putin in the manner that they might want to. I mean, they have to make noises that suggest they actually have a backbone.
Well, my understanding is that these sanctions brought about over Crimea and Ukraine do hurt Putin and the Siloviki around him, and they'd like to get out from under them. And, you know, the Steele report indicates that there was a brokerage fee for the 19% of Rosneft that was sold to people who we still don't know who that was sold to. And that was in the dossier, the Steele dossier, indicates right. that maybe, you know, that's the quid pro quo, you know, essentially a payoff to get us out from under this. Because I think there's no point in being paranoid about him and building him up. I mean, the whole country, Russia's economy is about the level of Canada's in terms of GDP. He has a lot of capacity to cause mischief, but most of what he's touched has blown up in his face, including Ukraine. I don't think it's worked out for anybody except, you know, that's been very painful. And Crimea's not working out for him. Georgia doesn't work out for him. He's just looting the country and distracting them with bread and circuses. And he's amazingly popular, and that's hard to understand. And I see a similarity there with Trump, too, being completely useless and ruining everything he touches because he doesn't know what he's doing. But at the end of the day, the real problem I have with Putin is not so much that he's somebody that we should be paranoid about, but that if he can put his guy in the White House, then that's where you can really do some damage, in the White House, not so much in the Kremlin.
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, 4 years of Trump, good Lord. and now he's thinking of 8 years. And the damage that Trump can do to this country, to its laws, to its institutions. I mean, he's already declared you as a representative of the media an enemy of the people. You know, I mean, I guess the academics might be next. I mean, so I'm waiting for that to happen, for the other shoe to drop any day now. But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Now, the problem about Trump, however, I mean, the problem about Trump and Putin is that the two of them, when you consider the both of them are individuals who are inadequate statesmen, inadequate political leaders, Putin has in the last few years absolutely devastated Russia, its standing in the world. Virtually every intervention, every major strategic move that he's made has turned out to be at best a non-winner for Russia, at worst even a disaster. So he's not doing very well. But when you take him and you combine the possibility, or indeed the likelihood, if not indeed the certainty, of Trump's acting in a similar manner, then you've got a significant portion of the world, essentially all of North America, a significant part of Eurasia, and the place in between, namely Europe, being susceptible to the sort of uncertain machinations of pathological liars and incompetence. I mean, this does not bode well for anybody, I'm afraid.
But, you know, obviously what he's done in Ukraine has backfired, and I think it's also happening in Poland and the Baltics. They're getting more and more concerned about security, and there'll be pushback against whatever ambitions he has to restore the Russian Empire or the Soviet Empire. Yeah. But at the end of the day, there's still, I mean, in Ukraine itself, you've still got an awful lot of corruption. Obviously, the choice is Putin wants Ukraine to be run by gangsters. Belarus is already run by a gangster. And that's what he's exporting, the same kind of government you have in Russia. That's the model.
Right.
So at what point in this struggle between European values and Russian values, where do we stand, you know, just in closing on, in terms of Ukraine? Is it just going to be a low-level guerrilla war forever, and it'll be almost impossible for Ukraine to clean up its act as well?
Well, I mean, you know, when you look at Ukraine, it's actually I'd say that the news is reasonably good. Now, what you hear in the Western press is just corruption, corruption, corruption. And, of course, that's true. There is. But at the same time, if you look more closely at reforms in Ukraine within the Ministry of Justice, within the Procurator's Office, that is to say the Attorney General's Office, within a variety of other ministries and so on, there's actually been some very impressive and very significant progress. Now, they still have a long way to go. But I'd say that when it comes to anti-corruption, I'd give the government over the last 3 years, I'd give them a B-. Right? You know, not exactly a great student, but they're obviously passing, and they're more than just passing by the skin of their teeth. When you read the Western press, it sounds like they're getting F's, but that's really not the case. It's more, as I said, it's more a B-, maybe a C+. But in any case, they're actually getting through the process and improving things. I mean, one could conceivably see Ukraine saying, you know, for the time being, why don't you just keep this territory and we'll work out the final status somewhere down the road. And Russia, for better or worse, saying, well, what the heck, we'll just hold on to this since we have it anyway. The fighting is likely to continue as long as Russia wants it to continue. And the only thing that would stop it is either a veto by Putin, which is unlikely anytime soon. The alternative would be some kind of international peacekeeping force. That would, of course, separate the two sides and presumably lead to some kind of end. But so far, Russia has been opposed to that. So, as I said, the ball is in Russia's court. The fighting is likely to continue. Unfortunately, the killing and the dying will continue. But there may be some kind of temporary solution somewhere in the foreseeable future, whereby the regions kind of get shunted off to the side by Ukraine, and Russia takes them under its wing, and then maybe something might happen.
Well, Alexander Mudl, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm your speaker with Alexander Mudl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, and he previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. And his latest book is Ukraine versus Russia, Revolution, Democracy, and War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.